Welcome to Academics Talk About the Chair. I'm Inga Mewburn. I'm a professor at the Australian National University and editor of the Thesis Whisperer blog. This podcast series is a lockdown project because, well, why not? It's late 2021, and as we record this, literally half of Australia is in lockdown, having the pandemic that the rest of the world had last year, which is actually very on brand for Australia when you think about it. So we're all in our homes, it's even a little bit rainy, and we're watching a lot of Netflix. In particular, we've been watching a new Netflix series called The Chair. As one of the only shows to ever depict a contemporary academic life as a comedy or drama, although I'll actually argue it's a romance, it's caused a lot of talk on social media. So we thought we'd talk about it together. We're four white female academics, and we loved it. And we wanted to tell you our opinions about the series. We'll do a recap, complete with spoilers, so look away now. Then we're going to talk about what's real, what's not, who had the best line, and importantly, the outfits. But first, some introductions.
Hi, I'm Narelle Lemon. I'm an associate professor in education at Swinburne University of Technology, and I blog and write about wellbeing and self-care at Explore and Create Co. And I just want to say that I subscribe to Netflix to watch The Chair.
Can't believe we've avoided Netflix that long, but respect.
And hi, I'm Megan McPherson. I'm a precariously employed artist researcher and educator in art and intercultural research, and I work at the University of Melbourne.
And thank you for representing the precariously employed, Megan, who weren't very well represented in The Chair, but we'll get to that. And finally.
Hi, I'm Anitra Nottingham. I'm ex-co-chair of a School of Graphic Design at a private art and design university in San Francisco who shall remain nameless. I am now professional staff at RMIT Online, where I head up the course design, designing online courses. I sound familiar because I am Inga's identical twin. It's very hard to tell us apart. So she's promised to sandwich me in between Narelle and Megan. So there's a little bit of an air gap between listening to her and listening to me. And I do know that my voices are crazy similar because my husband once saved a whole bunch of voice messages from when we were first married, or before we were married, actually. And I accused him of having an affair with my sister because why was she talking to you like that on those voice messages? It sounded way too affectionate because I'd forgotten them all, of course, which is a problem in itself, but also made me realize what it sounds like to other people. So we'll try not to get too confusing, right? Like, I'll develop sort of vocal tic or something. Yeah,
absolutely. Now, as you can tell, Inga again, just by the way, in case you're having trouble with that switch, which is the only bit of the script where we're together. So as you can tell, none of us are film studies academics. So don't expect a deep, informed analysis grounded in any kind of literature or theory. That's not what we're about here. We're taking our cue from projects like Doctors Watch Grey's Anatomy, which is on YouTube, where doctors compare their experience of hospitals with soap opera. We're going to compare our experience and knowledge of how the academic profession works in a fictional account on the screen with our own experience. Now, as I said, we are three white female academics located in Australia who've done various jobs inside academia, but of course we can't claim to have experienced everything. So this is our point of view. We hope we hear yours. We're dreaming of other people, maybe film studies academics, doing their own podcasts. But in the meantime, you can write to us and we'll include your ideas and opinions in our correspondence section at the end. But first, to our episode recap. This week, we're talking about episode one. The name of the episode is Brilliant Mistakes. There will be so many spoilers. So if you want to stop now and go and watch it, please do. Let's get straight into it. We open with Vivaldi and shots of a beautiful North American college campus. This is the fictional College of Pembroke. It's all, ooh, lovely American Oxbridge-ish. Our main character, the chair herself, Ji Yoon, played by the wonderful Sandra Oh, is walking to her new office across campus and through one of those classically beautiful buildings. She looks happy, maybe triumphant. Her walking is intercut with pictures of white guy portraits and bookshelves and other academically looking stuff. She gets to her office and unwraps a present left on her desk. There's a post-it note attached from Bill. It's a desk nameplate which reads, the fucker in charge of you other fuckers. And it was at this point that Mr. Thesis Whisperer and I just burst out laughing. And
got to get one of those.
Yeah, absolutely. She goes to sit behind her desk with big I have arrived energy, and her office chair promptly breaks. She yells, what the fuck, as she falls to the ground. And I don't know about you all, but I was totally hooked from this point, and we watched the whole thing in one go. And next we just see the credits. We do have typography.
Expert. Thanks. Yeah.
Anitra, do you want to tell us about the title?
Well, I got a bit excited when you asked me to do this because at first I thought it was Mrs. Eves, which would have been an inspired choice, right? So Mrs. Eves is a typeface, not a font, designed by a woman, Susanna Lico, in 1996. And she named it after William Baskerville's wife, who did all the work for his press and helped design Baskerville, but of course got no credit. So she named the typeface Mrs. Eves. It was inspired by Baskerville to redress his balance. But I had a look. I closely examined it. It's the leg of the R that's the bit of the tail and the shape of the E. And I thought it was Bembo, and then I looked it up to see if anybody else agreed with me, and it is Bembo. So Bembo, classic serif. Beautiful typeface, very easy to work with, and it screams classic upper class thing here, whatever you use it on. So you're not going to use it on a fish and chip shop, okay? Like, it really says this is literature. And it's also set in wide spaced uppercase with a smaller italic above, so it's very evocative of a 19th century setting. I think it's total perfection, although it's not Mrs. Eves. Maybe they can do that in season two. And you can see a similar sort of type treatment in the movie The Favourite, except it uses a little bit more of a broken down version, like a real lead typeface version of it. And it references the playbills of the time, because that's how they used to set the type quite wide like that. It's a very classic literature book cover treatment. Used it all the time when we were at Penguin. Also used it all the time at Oxford University Press. And I put little emphasis on all the time. I mean, it's your go-to when you want to say this is classy. This is literature. And I thought it was great.
Which is so amazing. Like, and thank you for that deep nerd dive there, because, you know, it's a show about a literature department, and therefore the type that you put on it is the type that you put on the re-release of a classic piece of literature, like Moby Dick, which is talked about a lot throughout the whole show. So I love that sort of double meaning. Okay, so next we see Ji-Yoon coming into her first departmental meeting, and it's taking place in a beautiful wood panel room with a marble fireplace, and there's more portraits of old white guys on the wall. There's also old white guys sitting at the table, and one of them welcomes our first lady chair and is swiftly corrected by the only black woman at the table, Professor Yas McKay, played really beautifully, I think, by Nana Mensah. Ji-Yoon is directed by her male colleague, Dr. Elliot Rentz, who's played amusingly by Bob Balaban, to sit at the head of the table. He then tries to stop her from starting the meeting because Bill is not there, and there's some little chatter about Bill's situation. Now, on rewatch, I was so impressed with the way that they set characters up from the get-go. So we've already learned Elliot's a stickler for the correct form. Yaz is a little bit tired of constantly having to assert a woman's place at the table. And Bill, who we shortly find out is a middle-aged white male academic, is missing. He's got a situation and everyone's cutting him slack about it. So we cut to Bill now, and he's played by Jay Duplass here, and he's seeing his daughter off to college. He's an attractively crumpled middle-aged guy, and he's emotional as he's saying goodbye. He's hugging his daughter just that little bit too closely, as you do with a 19-year-old who's pulling away, has got one of those at home. So I know that clinched well.
Yes, the feelings.
The feelings, yes. She leans back, takes him by the shoulders, and tells him firmly to get his shit together. And we learn instantly that she's more of the parent in this relationship right now. We cut back to the departmental meeting, and we hear enrollments are down. Ji-Yoon clearly and incisively starts to outline the problems the English department is facing, problems like convincing students to keep enrolling, and her speech continues to play over Bill getting tearingly drunk at the airport, pissing in the car park, then trying to find his car, and her final line, With information endlessly available to us, where shall wisdom be found, is amusingly juxtaposed with Bill stealing and then crashing a golf cart. Her colleagues seem to be enjoying the speech, but then the other missing faculty member, Joan, played beautifully by Holland Taylor. Joan's my favourite, spoiler alert.
Makes also, an entrance. By the way, no one said Joan's not here.
No, that's right.
No one said yes. That. Yeah.
No. Carry the invisible on. Older woman makes an entrance, complaining about having her office moved to the basement under the gym. The whole table is instantly switched into arguments about office space and mumblings about possible redundancy. And for me, this was just such a great academic moment, from the sublime and serious to the ridiculous and mundane, almost without taking a breath. We're next a cut to the Dean's office, and the Dean is played really well here, I think, by David Morse, who hands Ji Yoon a printout of the pay of each of the academics in her department. And the three oldest academics are on the top of the list. They're overpaid and underperforming. He wants her to find economies, probably by sacking them, and he apologises for springing it on her. But we get the sense he's actually been waiting for her to get into the job so he can make someone competent do the dirty work of getting the department back in budget. His complaints about the older academics having low enrolment numbers amusingly continues over a shot of Ji Yoon watching Joan pick up a student's frisbee and try and throw it back to them completely incompetently. A great visual metaphor alert. Ji Yoon immediately goes into bat for Yaz to get tenure. She sees Yaz as the future they need, but the Dean is clearly uninterested in both talent and pedagogy. He continues to complain about the level of student enrolment, which is a good intersectional moment, I think, that's very telling. And I could spend like a whole hour just unpacking this moment, because I won't, because that's kind of boring. But suffice to say that from the point of view of the Dean, we see him not even knowing the name of his only black faculty member at a party in the next episode, but that's going ahead. So I'll go back to where we are now. Ji Yoon counters his bean counting narrative by accusing him of putting Joan in the basement office. And the Dean is clearly surprised by this, and he asks how that happened. And some mysterious forces work here, clearly. And this moment, again, was really real to me. The Dean is the out-of-touch senior manager, sort of having no idea what's happening with his staff or around him, and yet obsessed with the numbers. And during this conversation, it's really clear the Dean admires Ji Yoon and is relying on her to bring Pembroke into the 21st century. But he can only see this modernism in terms of budgets and just a matter of getting rid of the staff who are out of touch with their students and not changing the way they teach. And Ji Yoon has other ideas, and this will boil out through the whole series. And we can see the problem that the dean is talking about when we cut to one of these staff members, Elliot, who's standing in front of a chalkboard in a large lecture room with mostly empty chairs. There's about four students there, and a fifth one comes in, and he's momentarily happy to see them. But she just asks if this class is sex and the novel, and then runs out again when she finds out it isn't. He is seen later standing shocked in the middle of hordes of students coming out of the sex and the novel class, which is being taught by Yaz over the hall. He's clearly put out at being less popular than this young upstart faculty member who does things so differently to him. Elliot will have quite a journey in this series, and spoiler alert, he never really arrives anywhere. But Yaz knows she has to flatter and defer to him. She's a survivor. She thanks him for chairing a tenure committee, but he doesn't answer and makes it clear that he's appalled at her modernising efforts, despite the fact that they clearly bring in all the students. He then rudely walks off mid-conversation. Yaz immediately goes to complain to Ji Yoon, who then confides to Yaz that Elliot's on the list and to be made redundant. And this is an attempt to make Yaz feel better, but it's also a beautifully observed moment of academic gossip where someone has information about someone else that they're not meant to tell them and then immediately tells them and then says, don't tell them. So
just why you have to have an extensive spy network.
Exactly. I actually had to stop and rewind this one again because I enjoyed it so much. She then asks Yaz to combine her class with Elliot's, and she sees this as a way to show Elliot how brilliant Yaz is. But Yaz is not impressed. She accepts that Ji Yoon is probably right, that he makes and breaks careers, and reluctantly agrees to go along with the plan. It's now the next day. We're in Bill's classroom where he's worried TA, that's his teaching assistant, his PhD student, who's texting him because he's not there. We see him wake up, presumably still drunk, on his daughter's bed and very confused about his car not being in the drive. One thing about Bill is, like, he's always getting up and throwing his clothes on. I'm like, does the man ever shower? I'm not quite sure. But I'm just imagining.
I think we see him in the bathroom at one point.
I really hope so. Yeah, because I just imagine he smells like old clothes and booze. Anyway, we see while Bill's trying to get ready and get himself to class, we see Elliot and Yaz in front of their now shared class. And he immediately makes her hand out the materials while he takes the stage and thanks her for joining them. This, I found this moment quite painful. And Yaz wearily gets on with the job. And I also really like the positioning of Elliot. Elliot's on the podium. He's the sage on the stage. And Yaz is there with the students, and she's always pictured like this as the sort of guide on the side. And the way that they use both academics in their teaching spaces talks to their teaching style. And I noticed that throughout every scene of academics teaching, it really tells you bucket loads about their personalities. Meanwhile, Bill is hurrying to get to work without his car. He picks up an electric scooter and then crashes it before he's offered a lift from an attractive female student who's driving a very nice Prius. Now, this is one of the moments, I think, where the show veers into cliche territory, but I'll allow it. I think it goes close to cliche often. It leans into it and then it sort of leans back at the right moment. We cut from Bill getting a lift with the undergraduate to Joan, and she's speaking to her class in a more modern but smaller theatre than Bill. And this set, again, is really carefully observed. We can see by where she is that she's got lesser status than Elliot, but she's got some of the same kind of style problems. She just lectures at the students, but there are more of them. And she's trying to convince them that Chaucer is still relevant, and they do not seem particularly engaged or won over by this argument. We then cut to Ji Yoon, and she's teaching in a book-lined room, my favourite room in the series. It's truly swoon-worthy space. And she, though she's talking from the front, she's encouraging her students to really think about the literature and express their views. Unlike Elliot, she doesn't see literature as fixed. Later on, one of her students at the end of the class asks her to sign a petition, and she hesitates and says, oh, is this a student petition? You can see her in her mind doing her calculus. Who am I at that moment? Am I management and I shouldn't sign a student petition? Am I a person of colour who should sign a student petition? She's really caught between worlds. But she does sign it, and I like her for it. That I'm on her side. I am Team Ji Yoon from this moment on. She's met at the door of her classroom by Joan, who's brought her a takeaway coffee to get her to come and check out her terrible new office. Meanwhile, Bill is being dropped off by the attractive undergrad who flatters him by asking him to sign a copy of his own book and calling him a household god. He looks uncomfortable, but at the same time, he does look quite susceptible to her charms. Cut back to the gym and we see a bunch of half-naked men working out, and Joan and Ji-Yoon stand there staring at them while Joan complains about the noise. Ji-Yoon agrees absently that it's terrible while clearly checking out all the man flesh. And Narelle's going to talk more about this moment later on. I'll just leave it there. We cut to Joan's pokey new basement office. Ji Yoon immediately starts getting riled up about Joan's situation and talks about plans for a Title IX fight. Do you want to tell us what Title IX is in the States?
I really should have looked up Title IX before we started recording this, just so that I had the really informed view. But so, as I understand it, having worked in the American system, it's about equal participation. And it mainly plays out in sport. And I think that was where the original statute came from. So it's about women's sport. So that's why you have women's basketball in the colleges and men's basketball. And there's always arguments about how much funding each one of them get. But it's also, when you think about equal participation, that's why sexual harassment cases come into Title IX, because they stop women from fully participating. So anytime that women are not able to fully participate, it's a Title IX fight. And it's quite in that American way where they're always arguing like about everything, like their whole system is set up that we're always going to argue about a thing and never really resolve it. That's why it becomes like a big thing. So they do actually have offices. We had one in our student support services, but it was never called the Title IX office like it is here, but I imagine it is in other places. So and I'll look it up and have a more informed opinion on it next time.
Well, Okay, that puts important context, I think. So she's trying to work out how can she fight this problem with Joan. She goes to a feminist touchstone of the Title IX complaint. And Joan hugs her, saying that the first woman chair is a troublemaker and she's so proud. Ji Yoon then gently tries to bring up the problem of Joan's terrible student evaluation, while Joan says she doesn't pander to consumers. Ji Yoon, now she's clearly got her work cut out for her with bringing Joan and the rest of them into the 21st century. I mean, also she clearly loves and respects Joan and they've got a long friendship, and it's going to be really hard for her to bring any kind of discipline or order to what's going on. And I think this moment again is about how our higher ed leaders are charged with making change, not really given any tools to do it, and then that the change can often harm people that they love. Their conversation then veers to the subject of Bill. Joan gives this valuable backstory here, and it's clear that Bill's situation is that he's been widowed a year ago and he's still not coping. Joan also tells us volumes about the complicated relationship between Ji Yoon and Bill. So clearly they adore each other and clearly they've kept it platonic. But now that his wife Sharon is dead, Joan wisely points out, there are no longer any guardrails. Into the familiar friends to lovers romance trope, one of my personal favourites, so I'm totally here for it. And I would argue the whole series follows a romance arc, and we'll name those sections. So we haven't had their meet cute yet, but we will shortly. Bill rushes into his death and modernism class, and his TA calmly but nervously helps him try and set his computer up. She's a bit worried about him, in no state really to give a lecture, which is proved immediately correct when Bill accidentally plays a video of his half-naked dead wife bantering with him while she's in labour with his daughter. And we guess that it's there because he was watching it before he closed the lid of his computer the night before, which is quite sort of sad and poignant, really. And his head is clearly not in the game because he watches the video with a smile on his face just a beat too long as his TA hurriedly rushes up to save him. And by the way, in romance terms, Bill's daughter and wife are being used as what they call a morality chain in the story, that they're being used to signal that he's a nice guy and an acceptable potential boyfriend for Ji Yoon, despite him being a total and absolute fuck up. And we then, of course, learn his TA's name is Lila when he graciously introduces her as writing a brilliant dissertation, and then says to her softly, which I will finish reading soon. And there's so much in this moment about PhD student-supervisor relationships. I immediately pegged Bill using Gatfield's 2005 matrix of supervisor type as the low structure, high support. And this is the worst kind of supervisor, in my opinion. So they're lovely, they're supportive, but they don't really do their job, which is to help you finish. And it's impossible to hate this kind of supervisor, even though they're really problematic. And I think this is Bill in a nutshell, and speaks to how our teaching style is an extension of ourselves in a really idiosyncratic way. We cut to Yaz and Elliot now discussing assessment, which is always a hot button issue amongst academics, and we could say so much about that too. He's really horrified about her idea of having the students tweet lines from Moby Dick, which he describes as flashy sound bites. She then defends herself, but ends up deferring to him as the Melville scholar. And this tiny moment was so telling about clashes of pedagogical style and class and race, but we'll pick this up later.
Ji Yoon, because yeah, I have thoughts on using Twitter. I have thoughts on like that whole assessment, and I have thoughts.
We'll like, get to it.
For me, this punctured Yaz's great teacher kind of. Anyway, we can get into that later.
Ji Yoon is surprised by Bill being in her office, and they tussle over the keys. He's got the keys to her office, like teenagers who can't admit they like each other, and so they have to play fight to get body contact. They're interrupted by her EA, who beats a hasty retreat, embarrassing Ji Yoon, who then accuses Bill of making her look unprofessional, which he does. But then she's nice to him, offering emotional support. And the awkwardness in this moment is really well played. They're really having trouble managing professional and personal boundaries, which is just a problem in academia, full stop. She then unburdens herself to Bill about the problems of the department. And it becomes clear in this conversation that Bill was the previous head of department And this is somehow all news to him. And this bit made me so mad. She's been expected to solve all the problems in the department that had clearly been going on for ages, and he was never made to step up and do anything. And she says one of my favourite lines in the whole show at this point, where she says, "I feel like I arrived at the party after the last call," which really sums up how I feel about being a woman in academia. We're finally let in, we're given the keys to the shop, it's a fucking mess and the fun is over. And we finish this scene with GU warning Bill not to get rides from students, because she's had a call from the dean of students. And apparently the undergraduate with the car is the daughter of a trustee and therefore important.
Money is obviously important. Also, that's telling, because she only got a place because she's what do they call them? A heritage something trustee. Or other enrollment. There's a name for being an enrollment because your family paid money to the school to build something, and
the
inference there is that she didn't get there on her own merits, potentially. That's the inference as well, which is amusing, I think.
So there's levels of because of cultural knowledge that we don't have necessarily about the American system, so American readers, listeners might have views. But so I didn't really understand that level of that layer of referencing there, but that's good to know. Ji-Yoon tells Bill that she needs him to be on his best behaviour for the health of the department, and he's about to give her shit for being all managerial, but she tells him quite fondly to go away. We cut to Ji-Yoon's house, where her young daughter has been looked after by her elderly father. And I'm not sure how old Juju is meant to be, maybe 7 or 8, but she's unnaturally mature for her age, so it's hard to tell. Ji-Yoon's dad speaks Korean, presumably so that Juju can't understand what he's saying. And we quickly learn that Ji-Yoon previously had a fiance, and that her father still wishes she was with that man, and that Juju is troubled and the psychiatrist is worried about her. And we cut to Ji-Yoon and Juju brushing their teeth with beautifully observed bamboo toothbrushes. Like, as a resident of the Canberra Inner North academic set, you know, you have to have a bamboo toothbrush. And I think they have a really cute relationship. As the mother of a child, an only child of an academic, I see a lot of my kid in Juju. She can talk to her mother with really sophisticated vocabulary. My kid was tested at a similar age as having the vocab of a 24-year-old because he was talking to me all the time and didn't have a sibling. And that doesn't really go down well in the playground. And I'm pretty sure the same thing's happening for Juju, and she feels quite alienated. But she's still a kid and she's really confused about the world, and she's worried about who will take care of her when Ji-Yoon dies. And she's also really reluctant to accept comfort. She's too smart for that to work. And Ji-Yoon we see her looking worriedly later at the hilariously scary drawing the psychologist was worried about that Juju did at school. And she contemplates a business card with the name of a counsellor on it. And I have a joke that no middle-class child of academics goes through primary school without seeing a psychologist. And it seems Juju is about to have her first visit. Cut to the next day, and we're back with June pursuing the Title IX complaint about her office change with an administrator. She's texting Ji-Yoon, who seems to have abandoned her to deal with it on her own. And we see what Ji-Yoon is dealing with when we cut to her walking across campus, and Lila, Bill's TA, rushes up to say that Bill has gone AWOL yet again. Ji-Yoon finds him asleep in her office and then reads in the Riot Act. He doesn't bother arguing, but he sort of slowly gets up and really struggles with his shoes, and she ends up doing them up like he's a child. And although it was funny, I was so annoyed at this moment because he's just such a hot mess, and he's getting attention and he's taking it away from Joan, who really needs Ji-Yoon to back her up, as we find out in the next scene, where we're back with Joan and her fight about her office. While the administrator is sympathetic, she points out that they're under resources and offers no solutions. And that will be no surprise to anyone who's tried to get justice about something like this inside a university, that there's no process to handle it. What a surprise. Joan's not helping her own. Joan's not helping her own case, though. She jokes about sexual harassment maybe being welcome at her advanced age. And then she talks about truth having no moral loading, and that it's just a statement of fact, before she proceeds to morally load the heck out of it by telling the young woman off for her short shorts that show her pussy. It's clear she's absorbed some patriarchal norms in her 32 years at Pembroke. We cut back to Ji-Yoon and Bill walking out of the building while she berates him for not having finished his syllabus. He tries to make a joke about it, but she tells him seriously, in an echo of his own daughter, to get his shit together and to start showing up. Bill listens, and the last scene is him standing in his lecture theatre trying not to phone it in for a change and actually teach. And this is where he makes the brilliant mistake in the title by doing an ironic Hitler salute while talking about fascism. He doesn't notice he's being filmed by a student who's probably expected to catch him having yet another meltdown. And the lecture seems quite good, but the students are starting to share the video on social media and we know trouble is brewing. Cut to black here. Quick shout out for the excellent sound design. I think the songs and the way music is used in the show is really clever. Now, I totally love this episode and I loved it even more the third time I watched it to write the recap. But the chair has been causing a bit of a stir online. It seems every academic has a hot take. Some think it's hilarious, while others don't even think it's remotely funny. Some say it's totally cliched and unrealistic, while others say that it's too much like work. As is typical of academia, opinions are divided and everybody thinks they're right. And my favourite tweet so far has been from @NelsonFlaws, who said, "One third of my news feed is saying how realistic the chair is and calling people criticising it obnoxious. One third is providing a point-by-point critique of what it gets wrong. And one third is claiming moral superiority for refusing to watch it. And now I feel like I'm actually in a faculty meeting." just so perfect. But what did you think? I'll start with you, Megan.
Too realistic, too close. It, like those moments in those meetings where, you know, you could just see all the white faces and you just think, oh, yeah, that's it. I'm here again. And I hated Bill already.
We're going to change your mind, Megan.
No, I can see the emotional labour that I will have to do in my job that will, you know, put me out. And I'm just like, yeah, nah, don't like you.
But I love She's got folded arms now in case, you know, just,
No, she really doesn't like him. We've got our work cut out for us.
Yeah. Anitra, what about you?
Well, I wrote, had me at enrollment is down, but it had me before that, like especially coming from having a managerial background in education, like some of it, well, most of it was just completely spot on. And I had expected so much from this. Netflix didn't recommend it to me, which I was really offended about. It's still not recommending it to me, even though I've watched it twice, which... And I said that the only other show that hasn't disappointed me that I'd expected a lot from was Guardians of the Galaxy, the first one, and therein probably is why Netflix doesn't think that I want to watch this. It thinks I'm a bit lowbrow. But, yeah, no, I laughed even more than I expected. It brought me joy. I really enjoyed it.
Excellent. And how about you, Narelle?
Well, I was really surprised that I liked it. I laughed a lot. And maybe it was a release of all the good and bad in academia and feeling seen, understanding it. And I honestly thought it was more authentic than I expected. And I'm also wondering, because I'm in lockdown 6 in Melbourne here, I needed a laugh. And so it gave me permission to just laugh it all out with that, you know, resonating so closely to many of the scenes and what was being said. And I'm going to say something controversial here, but as of episode 1, I really like Bill. I had empathy for him. You know, his wife has passed away. He's the ex-chair. He's a potential love interest. I think he could be supportive. I kind of like the rubble.
He's been milking it for a year.
Hey, grief takes a long time, you know. Everyone is a unique person.
And he does it somewhat attractively, Megan. That's not an insignificant thing.
I kind of like the disheveled look. I don't know what that says about me, but yeah, but I'm just gonna say it. I liked Bill.
Later on, he does bring good scruff game to this, and you know, as a facial hair enthusiast, I was here for it. All right, so let's dig a little deeper, team. First of all, I want to talk about what we thought was the most realistic scenes or aspects, and what did it actually capture about academia or critique it? Narelle, you first.
Okay, well, I really liked Yaz and her comment about my office hours are Tuesdays and Thursdays from 1 to 2, but you can come anytime because I basically live here. And I was like, yep, that's a very accurate depiction of teaching, what comes with teaching, especially when we're investing in the relationships with our students, we're passionate about what we teach. And I was like, yep. That's as much as we try to carve out what our office hours will look like, our consultation hours look like. They're always, always different. Also liked Yaz on Elliot and her comment about he hasn't updated those lectures in 30 years when she was being asked to co-teach with him. And I have been in that situation before and so resonate. And I had a close third little realistic moment where I was like, the first staff meeting, and we've got the board table and we've got all the white men there, the dominant male around the board table in the suits, and I could resonate with that. I've been in that position quite a number of times, being the only female around that board table and what comes with that. So,
And I think also being the only young person in the room, or there being very few young people in the room and most people being older. For years I've been telling my hairdresser to please don't touch my greys, and I've been cultivating my greys carefully. And then last time she just forgot and she dyed them and I was like, what? So I made her give me tone shampoo so that I could knock them back. And I've always really loved your grey hair, Megan. Like, it's just such an asset, such a career asset, I think. Anyway, yes. I've
clearly got it wrong then. I've dyed my hair red in lockdown because I can't maintain the blonde with no hairdresser. So maybe I should grow it out with the grey.
Try it. I'm just saying. I've found it advantageous. How about you, Anitra?
Well, for me, it was the scene with the dean, and that that phrase, enrollment is down. Also heard the phrase, five students in a course, and having to retain students. I just... that's just my life. I had a dollar for every time I've heard those words. And enrollment is down is the catch-all reason for why something shitty is happening too. Like, always. Like, it's a convenient excuse, but it's also true, right? And it's a scary thing. And it just speaks to the commercialization of the university. And then the bit where he tells her to use her persuasive powers as chair to, you know, basically fire, well, I don't know if Elliot's her friend, but Joan's definitely her friend, you know, like, fire your friends, they're old and they're not performing anymore, and we're not going to just do it in a straightforward way, like, you know, we're going to get you to emotionally manipulate them. And I just, like, this just fired the mirror neurons for me. I was just like, I started to try and figure out how she could solve her problem. And I was like, wait, this is not my problem. I don't have to solve this problem. And how she's trying so hard to keep Yaz, like, that when you don't have a lot to keep talented faculty like that, and when they do feel shut out, like, that's a really hard conversation to have. Why don't they get the classes, even with casualized work? Why don't they get the work that people get? And how hard she's trying to persuade her, and that's why she uses that bit of gossip to reassure her with, and like, oh, just, that's very realistic and very difficult. And, you know, I was appointed as a director, so I had structural power that she doesn't have, because she has to keep everybody sweet. And that's the thing, you can go from being a chair to not being a chair, right? And you've got to preserve those relationships. Whereas, you know, if you're really empowered, you can do things differently. And it's just, it's kind of messed up. It makes me really think about that should really change, like, because she's not really properly empowered at all. And then later when Joan doesn't cater to consumer demands, and that refusal to see a student as a customer, like, it's totally understandable, and in some sense it's completely right. At the same time, it's so completely infuriating when you're the one who has to worry about it. And it's also such a defensive screen that gets thrown up. Like I don't have to listen to what the students have to say. And you do. I like to talk about us being coaches in a gym where students are given all the tools to become something other, and something better, hopefully, than they were when they entered. And that still means that they are a customer on some kind of level, even though they're not directly buying goods and guaranteed to success, and all those sorts of things are wrapped up around that. And just the look on Ji-Yoon's face, I'm like, yeah, girl, been there. Very infuriating. Somewhat triggering.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. How about you, Megan?
My line was spoken by Elliot to one of the other really, really old professors, and the future is online education. If it was up to them, we'd all be teaching in our skivvies. Now is the future. It was actually like 15 years ago. Can we just, like, get real?
I know, right? Like, I've been doing online education since 2006, and I'm not an early comer to the online thing. And that attitude about online, you know? It's been such an accelerant, though, the pandemic. Like, those guys have had to teach. It's been interesting to watch people be put in the position of
or
having
not
to teach.
Yeah. That too. The pandemic is actually the reason why that people are leaving of that generation. They don't want to work online.
I've actually seen, I think, more older people leave the profession in the last year than ever before in my 20-year career. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yes. And it's been interesting.
Is that always a bad thing?
No. No. Not at all.
I mean,
it's interesting that it's this generational change and it's happening like in a group. Like, and that I think is that academic knowledge that we're losing in a group. It's not being maybe handed over. It's not being maybe mentored through anymore. So, and it's when, for example, professional staff leave in a group, you find that there's this big holes in processes because the people who were doing those roles are no longer there who know the process. And it's like someone, like, that process doesn't exist. It's like wiggling around on the ground sort of thing, you know, without a purpose. And, you know, to find those structures again is sometimes difficult, and that costs money.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And another flip to that is that COVID has actually revealed everything that they've been getting away with for so long and have been covered up for. Right.
You know, Joyce,
playing the other flip, right?
Joyce always talks about online education being like a nightclub raid. And then it's 3 a.m. and the lights go on and the drugs drop to the floor and the cockroaches scurry to the corners. Because what online always brings is structure, and we're like, where is your syllabus? Like, the idea that Bill hasn't done his syllabus and he's a couple of weeks in or a week into classes, like, that just doesn't fly when you're online, right? And it's that idea is like, we come in and we're like, where's your stuff? Where's your papers? Where's your things? What do you do here? And they all go, you know, and that's happened on a massive scale across the world. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, it is fascinating.
And this is one of the things I'm so glad that you could all come and join, you know, the podcast together, was that I just want to talk to someone about this stuff, because it does bring up all these thoughts as you're watching it about your lived professional world. So I wanted to move us on now. We're going to unpick now the most unrealistic details or scenes. And I'm interested in whether they're things you wish were true or not. So, Narelle, what's your most unrealistic scenes?
Bill at the airport, we're presuming it's early in the morning. He's saying goodbye to his daughter. She's off to college. Bye-bye, daughter. He's like throwing back a massive amount of beers at the hotel, at the airport bar. He's clearly drunk. Can't find his car. He's walking around with the bopper going beep, beep, beep. He's like going through layers, can't find it. Golf buggy, hello, great idea. Right now, we forget he's an academic and you think he's like an 18-year-old, 19-year-old young man going, sweet, I'm going to take that golf buggy. I'm going to drive it around to try and find his car in the car park. But, you know, up the hill and just flips. And it's just, you know, it's hilarious, but just saying, putting it out there, unrealistic. But in regards to academia, there's no emails, there's no spreadsheets, there's hardly any meetings, there's hardly any of those chats that are going on as we problem solve across multiple levels. You know, I would love there to be no emails and far less spreadsheets than currently come through my life at the moment. But, you know, there's an inbox of paper on her desk.
Is that meant to say that things are a little bit behind, maybe? Like,
it could be.
Maybe.
It is entirely unrealistic not to have spreadsheets. Like, spreadsheets alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about you, Anitra?
Yeah, agreeing with Narelle about the email and the spreadsheets. Like, lots more conversations happen between people than would normally happen on email. Like, you can imagine some of those exchanges would have happened on email, right? Yeah, but I guess that doesn't make good TV, so that's fine. And emails are also digital. Tableau, hello. You know, there's a lot of analysis that goes on with those things. But you can imagine that they were printed out. And I also like that the printout it looked a little dog-eared, like people had been trying to get her to look at these printouts for a really long time. Like, I guess it's unrealistic, but it's
Just adding to the pile.
Yeah, just like here's another year's worth. Because there's no way she would have tried to access them online, you know. Look, her reaction's also totally understandable. Just like, I mean, not to brag, mine were always good, okay? My evals were always good. But they do rule my life as head of course design now, because that's how we judge the success of our courses as well. So I can imagine just not wanting to read them. I don't know. That doesn't seem unrealistic now. That seems very realistic. So I think I'm wandering away from, but definitely I'd seen a lot of chatter about, you know, but they're not printed out. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of the point. Like, not printed out, because there's no way Joan would read them. Like, they're terrible. Anyway, yes. I did find the daughter seemed quite relatable, the way that she spoke, by the way. Like, I've got a smart mouth zoomer. They hate that word, so that's why I use it, zoomer, myself. Yes. And he would totally say something like that to me, 100%. Like, I find their relationship quite relatable in some ways. I've done the opposite of what you asked me to do. So, which probably explains why I failed all my essays in art school, because that was that was my modus operandi. Oh, you want me to write about blah? Well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to write something else that's going to blow your mind, you know. Anyway,
doesn't meet the rubric. I actually walked in on my son yesterday to give him some lunch or something, and he was cutting and pasting the rubric into a document and then like doing his text under the rubric. I'm like, I felt so proud. And then I said to him, oh, is this essay due soon? And he said, oh, it's due in 10 days. You know, that sounds like a lot, but it really isn't very much.
No, it's really not.
And I was so proud. I almost cried.
Even more.
Job is done.
All right. Okay, team. Now for you, what was the funniest scene or maybe the most touching moment? So I'll start with you, Narelle.
Oh, wait, did we miss Megan?
Did we miss Megan? We did. Megan.
I've got
most unrealistic. Yeah, you do.
I've got to talk about
that. You have to talk about that. Yeah.
Yes.
Because you know, having a large office to yourself, you know, if you're chair, yes, but other staff members may not have offices themselves, and I was always really interested in Elliot and Jazz sort of working together over the desk, and that would be infuriating to share an office with Elliot. But it, you know, even having an office is a privilege, you know, in contemporary universities, and like I work at the University of Melbourne, we do have buildings like that. I went into the building where they actually have their big board meetings, and you know, it's a stunning huge table with, you know, amazing chairs. It's never used except for those meetings, but it's very interesting to see that and then compare it to our meeting room in my faculty, which is an old police hospital surgery which still has the tiles on the walls
because
it's historical.
Not nice. That's not nice.
What do they have to hose down after the academic?
It's ready for a hose down at any time.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, and you're so right. I mean, open plan offices and academic work are pretty inconsistent with each other, and yet more and more academics are being asked to hot desk or to move into open plan offices, and then people wonder why morale is low and people are upset. It's not rocket science. We used to have shared offices, and we moved offices earlier this year, and it was amazing. We all had a separate office. Suddenly we're so much more productive because you can't run a Zoom class from an open plan office. And I do like the way that theme runs under things a lot through this, is space and power.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Because I know that the first thing that happened when our chair became the chair emeritus was that her office was the one that the new chair got. That was the first order of business, was like moving offices to get the good office. They're both amazing offices, both huge with like views out onto San Francisco streets. And I'm not like putting down either of those people who I both love, but I totally got why the new person wanted the new office. You know, it was just more centrally located. It was, you know, it had a little bit more of a buffer so people couldn't just walk straight in on you. It had all those things.
And my new office.
It is status and power.
My new office is in a building from the 1950s, and it's actually two offices. I've got an antechamber that you walk through to get to my office, and that antechamber was built for the typist.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
So in the 1950s, you were I've got a professor's office from then, which is huge. It's nice. Like, I'm not like privilege is showing now, but I've got this massive office and this little antechamber where you would have had your typist. That blows my mind, that sort of physical reminder that we used to have people to do our typing. Imagine that. The party really is over, people. Okay, funniest scene, most touching moment. Narelle.
Okay, funniest scene, opening scene with the chair, laughing out loud within 2 minutes, probably under 2 minutes, where she goes to sit down, she's at her desk, and it just breaks, and it just bangs, she's on the ground, a few F-bombs going off there, and it's just so relatable because academia has so crappy chairs. Like, if you think of chairs in classrooms and the chairs that are in the corridors,
it really does.
Chairs that are broken and piled under staircases where they think no one's going down those staircases. Like, every single university you walk into has got these spaces. So I just, you know, and it reminded me of our dear friend Chin Ku, who has the sad chairs of academia on Twitter, and and documenting visually them. And it's just like, here's a chair. You're supposed to have, like, I don't know, the assumption that you'd have these beautiful ergonomic chair that's, you know, lovely and beautiful. And there she goes, bang, sit on her ass.
Yes, so true.
And the other thing that got me in terms of a little bit of a laughable moment was Ji-Yoon and Joan checking out the situation of Joan's office being moved to the under the wellness center, which happens to be the gym. And they're over there with their takeaway coffee, and Joan's like, "See what I have to deal with? I can't hear myself think." And Ji-Yoon's just looking, her eyeballs are hanging out of her head, and she's like, "Yep, it's terrible. I mean, a gym, hot guys working out, you know."
I do love how Joan gets sucked into that too. Like she's like suddenly going, "Oh yeah, I had no. Oh yeah, actually, it's kind of hot."
So that power of the women's gaze, the role reversal being shared here, as well as the, you know, the bit of the writers. And normally it would be the males checking out the chicks working out in their little brief numbers. And yeah, so it's, yeah, they were my two laughable moments.
Good.
Just interesting to me how Bill's not allowed to have the ride with the hot girl and they're checking out the hot guys, and it's different reaction, but you know.
Yeah.
Interesting.
How about you, Anita?
I didn't go for funny because Narelle stole all the funny ones. Well, not all the funny ones, because they're lots of funny, but they were my bits where I was just laughing. I love that gym scene. It was very funny. So I went for poignant, and that's a scene where Ji-Yoon couldn't comfort her child about dying. My mother died when I was 28. My children never met her. So they often ask about her. And so I've had that very conversation with, like, she died. How do I know you're not going to die? And also it wasn't resolved. You know, she walked away from it and you're like, "You didn't fix that, Ji-Yoon," but, you know, do you ever fix anything in a conversation as a parent? Never, never, never. That was very poignant and realistic. And also I really liked Bill's lecture, and like just I went to art and design school, so I've had very few kind of experiences and lectures like that. And I think this is probably why I listen to a lot of them on audiobook now. But his lecture was really good. But at the same time, you're like, "Oh, he's a really good teacher." And then you're like, "Oh, no, like his career's going to be over." Like, it was very poignant for me. And just pointing out that he's in the same lecture hall as Elliot. So, you know, their careers are over, really, but for different reasons. It's a very interesting moment. Okay, all right.
How about you, Megan?
I went for a touching moment, and that was when Ji-Yoon is talking to the dean, and through the window you see the Greek chorus of the three elderly scholars walking past, and Joan tries picking up the frisbee to throw it in return to the student throwing the frisbee, and she completely stuffs it up. And, you know, just that contrast between the dean and Ji-Yoon's conversation there, it was just hysterical.
Yes, delicious moment, yeah. Okay, best lines. It's got very clever dialogue, this show, and we just want to pull out a few lines to just savour them. Narelle, what's there for you?
"I will not allow this department to be ransacked," said by a chair with passion, invigoration, strength. And then 5 minutes later, the dean's handing her a piece of paper. It's got a list on it, and he's talking about generous retirement packages and use your persuasiveness, and it just reveals such a disconnect between you've got a significant leadership role yet you have no power at all. And my other thing I want to talk about is the student evaluations and Joan making the comment about, I'm not trying to be popular. And just that, those thoughts, you know, there's a lot of feels here in terms of evaluations. I'm someone who's always read mine, being proud of the scores that I get in the role that I have now. I have the honor of reading everybody else's and seeing what there is to celebrate them, to help them grow, to look at how we can showcase what's happening across the school. And I started to think about that place of evaluations, and, you know, students can be so harsh, they can be nasty. There's that we can be rocking in the corner, we can not want to open them, click that PDF open because of past experiences. And then we've got the flip side of these student evaluations being used for promotion, for teaching excellence awards. People quote their students when they say, I loved you, I loved what you were doing, and all those sorts of aspects. So there's this, like, student evaluations can be used against us, they're complex. And I wanted to, you know, does any leader really, really do anything with them to really support pedagogical development? We don't hear about that in our world of academia. So, you know, the student evaluations, Joan's line of, I'm not trying to be popular, just unraveled so many layers for me.
So many feelings.
We all had our triggers, didn't we? How about you, Anitra?
I agree with Narelle's, by the way, again. And then I really like that little throwaway line of, how many people did the reading? I mean, honestly. Yeah. That was really good.
How about you, Megan?
He's going to think I'm his TA. That's Yaz to Ji-Yoon. And so true. And how can Ji-Yoon not see that? You know, you know, that was for me really telling. And then Ji-Yoon talking to Bill, you need to start showing up. And, you know, Bill trying to, you know, push back on that one. And then Ji-Yoon just basically says, you know, when you were the chair, I wasn't fucking phoning it in. You know, the amount of labour she's had to do for this person, you know.
Bill, you know, is really terrible, Megan.
Been, you know, mourning through this period, and not just mourning, you know, just doing, he's been bringing it to school, you know, he's bringing the baggage along, and he's bringing the bad behavior along, and, you know, the emotional labor that's going on here makes my skin crawl.
Fair. Okay. All right. Let's get on to our last and most important segment. Let's talk about outfits. Costumes in this show are great, I think. We're just going to share our favourites in this episode. So, Narelle, what was your favourite costume look in this episode?
Well, I'm sharing my love for Bill here, and I quite like his dishevelled look all the way through. But I particularly love the moment when he's riding that scooter and he goes head over arse. And we see him pop up, and the disheveledness has that addition of leaves, just so carefully placed.
Yes, it's great. Yes, and very good scruff, as I've already said.
Yes, absolutely.
Anitra, what about you?
Oh, I really love Ji-Yoon's first day outfit as chair, and it's an echo of Bill's outfit, actually, because she's got the similar kind of, I think it's a check blazer. She's got a button-down shirt that's buttoned up all the way, and then she's got multiple necklaces, like sort of thin ones, sort of stylishly arranged. And it's just perfection. I just think it sums up everything she's trying to do. And, you know, it's kind of the man's outfit but not. And she's just, yeah, she's really rocking it. So that was my favourite point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I love that echo of Bill doesn't have to try, but she does.
Yeah, hers is all neat. Yeah.
How about you, Megan?
Well, I always love a duffel coat, you know. That's a fine-looking duffel coat. The Pembroke T-shirt for sleeping attire. And yes. Who has university apparel? I know that Inga does. and I was thinking about this morning. I have university apparel, but it's faculty level. It's not the university level. So it's like the sub-level. So it's, you know, a way of showing my grouping, I think, in my faculty. You know, it's quite interesting. In
discreet.
That
sense. Yes.
It's discreet. Like, it doesn't have a big Melbourne on the front of it.
and it's Ji Yoon who's got that duffel coat. We see it a couple of times, don't we?
Yes, we do, as she's walking through. And the most put-together person is Bill's TA, which is Lila.
Mm. Yes. The PhD. Yeah. She's classy. Yeah.
Yeah, great outfits. Yeah.
Great glasses. Yeah, I want her glasses. Yeah. I'm going to jump in with my opinion here because I haven't given an opinion on the other things, but Joan's beige cable knit cardigan that she wears to the scene in the administrator's office, absolutely perfect. I love how Joan has symphonies of beige and that clashes somewhat with her dyed hair. And she just, you know, she's got a fairly matchy-matchy wardrobe, obviously. She just pulls whatever out of it and it's all boring, so it all goes together. So, and that's that whole, like, my body's a station wagon for my brain type of, it doesn't matter how I look, I'm not going to wear makeup. But I could really relate to. So anyway, great. So that's all our opinions and feelings. But what about you? We've got a correspondence section here already. I'm going to read the first text message that I got from a friend who's held a similar position to Ji Yoon in the past in the States, but prefers to remain anonymous. Has clipped out a few things. It's a very long text message. Like I said, everyone's got all the thoughts. And so my friend says, parts of the chair reminded me so much of my own experiences with the patriarchy of education professors at my university. There were many scenes and characters that felt very close to home. And she thought Bill encapsulated everything that was good and evil about the academy, the tortured genius who the university can't afford to keep or lose. She also related to bringing a woman in to lead the charge and then her being undermined by the dean. Ugh. And honestly, the dilemmas that she faces and challenges of parenting relationships and having a career at the same time was very real to her. And but that she also found Sandra Oh's character to be both hilarious and painfully sad. And she wonders how society sees female academics and leaders. And that's an interesting question we can return to. Mm. My friend Gemma Carey, at Gem Carey on Twitter, found the show haunting because of the storyline of Ji Yoon adopting because her partner and her split up in the mid-30s over the two-body problem in academia. And the two-body problem being a well-talked-about problem in academia where you're partnered and you're in a town that's only got a job for one of you, and do you choose your career or your partner? And clearly Ji Yoon's chosen her career. Okay, that's all for the first episode of Academics Watch the Chair. This was take two, actually, and I think we did it really well.
Good on us.
Good on us. We've got our sound problems all sorted out. So thank you for listening. Like we said, we're four white female academics in Australia. These are our thoughts and our reactions. We're really interested in yours. You can email me in the address of the show notes or leave a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you rate us, we're easier to find. You can also just leave me a spoken question, which I can cut into the show, or a spoken feedback. It's www.speakpipe/thesiswhisper. I'll put that in the show notes too. We'd love to hear from you. All right. So
we actually listen to the feedback, right?
We will.
We listen to
our emails.
We adjust.
Emails. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. Okay. So where can people find you on the internet, Megan?
I can be found on the internet at Megan J. McPherson on Insta and Twitter, and where you'll meet my academic cats, Maximum, Dulcie, and Mr. Finn.
Who in this take of the show have not made an appearance.
No.
Not climbing over things and.
Next time. Yeah,
well trained.
Next time.
Narelle, where can people find you?
On Twitter, you can find me at Rallypops and at WellbeingWisp1. And on Instagram, you can find me at Rallypops and Explore and Create Co.
Excellent. And Anitra?
I'm just at AnitraNot on all the things, Twitter, Instagram. Pinterest is where I have the most followers. And for anyone interested in typography, I have a very good typography board if you want to check it out, not to brag.
And you can find me at Thesis Whisperer on Twitter. You can Google Thesis Whisperer. You find me everywhere. Thanks, friends.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. So much
And
fun.
Thank you. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
See you later. Bye.